Welcome to Money Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment, and strategic decision-making. If you're a fund selector, independent financial advisor, or institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis, and expert opinions to enhance your perspective, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uestam. Today is our 12th installment of an underlying series in partnership with Morningstar South Africa and their head of investment, Sean Nietling, called Mind Over Markets, where we provide the latest insights on monthly investment trends and market developments. The first quarter of 2025 was once again a reminder that markets don't move in a straight line. US large caps experienced their first decline since October 2023 as markets digested increasing geopolitical risk, the emergence of AI competitors outside the US, and a Liberation Day speech that was anything but American first. By contrast, European equities led by Germany delivered their strongest outperformance relative to US stocks since 2006. But tariffs and its effect on markets continue to dominate discussions, with US President Donald Trump now having passed the milestone of 100 days in office. So against this ever-changing backdrop, what have we learned? Is this a time to be more cautious or more optimistic? What, if anything, has changed over the last quarter? And most importantly, how can investors get the odds on their side given the amount of news coming their way on a daily basis? To help me answer some of these questions, I welcome you back to the studio, Sean. Welcome.
Thanks, Ruan. Good to be back.
So let's dive into this month's theme, Trump trades and learning from his first 100 days. It rhymes. Sean, how would you rate your estimates of the US presidency? What did you call correctly? What surprised you most? And what does your overall report card for him look like?
Sure, Ruan. Look, so I think we don't really frame it in terms of calling things correctly or incorrectly. I think, you know, in this type of environment, it's especially important to hold views fairly lightly. But if we did apply that framework to, let's call it, Trump's first 100 days in office, I'd say the only things that were in line with our expectations was really to expect the unexpected and not rely too much or not rely on any forecasts. I think, you know, Trump's approach was more extreme than our base case assumptions. And this probably culminated with the Liberation Day speech that we saw at the start of April. I think that was really the point of us stepping back and saying, look, nobody really knows how things will play out, probably not even Trump himself. And guessing what he may or may not do sits well outside our circle of competence. So investing countless hours trying to predict, you know, what is going to happen is probably not the best use of our time. I think the one thing we could control is portfolios. So as a team at Morningstar, we really stepped back and looked at how we could mitigate some of the risks that we were seeing in markets and then position client portfolios more optimistically and more opportunistically for some of these extremes. So I think we used volatility that that we saw in the first 100 days and in the first quarter to really rebalance portfolios and maintain sort of those overweights to parts of the world that we thought were priced below what we think their fair values are. I'd say in terms of a report card, it's probably too early to say anything too definitive. There's still a fair amount of gamesmanship going on. You've got a second term president here that appears to be determined to leave his mark on history and was effectively elected on the basis of his America First policies. So I think up until, you know, Liberation Day, it appeared to be a very hardline approach that he was taking, but it does appear as though that softened somewhat as the economic market and business impacts became a bit more clearer. And I think also the news that we saw this week around an agreement with China to potentially roll back tariffs is again evidence of a more diplomatic approach than maybe what was priced into markets, let's say, in the first quarter of this year. So too early to probably say in terms of a report card. It does appear to be that some of the more sort of onerous policies are being walked back to a certain extent, again, as these market impacts become a bit more tangible.
Sean, we are now a month into the second quarter, and the US Federal Reserve seems quite spooked by what a tariff war could mean for the future. What are your expectations around inflation, interest rates, and growth? And can you frame the current environment for us and talk us through the conundrum the Fed faces?
Yeah, Ron, that's a great question. I think with regards to the Fed, there's probably two layers of uncertainty. The first is policy uncertainty. So where will tariffs be 2 or 3 months from now? You know, never mind 2 or 3 years from now. And should we expect fiscal policy to also shift? And more specifically, will tariff revenue in the US be recycled back into the economy as tax cuts or spending? So there's a few things that are known unknowns there. And then second and equally important is the uncertainty around how the economy reacts to tariffs. And the Fed really is in a predicament here. To what extent will businesses and consumers cut back their spending? How much will, I suppose, U.S. domestic production be able to step up to replace higher import costs? So I think the challenge that the Fed faces is really, this well-known tension between managing inflation and then supporting growth. And if you frame that, tariffs will have a negative impact on GDP growth and potentially also cause unemployment to rise somewhat. But tariffs will also push up inflation. So if you take, I suppose, that slowdown in the economy or potential slowdown in the economy, potentially higher unemployment leading to recession risk potentially, that would potentially call for a more aggressive reduction in interest rates compared to what markets are thinking, while higher inflation would call for, I suppose, a higher path for interest rates compared to the baseline that we're seeing. So right now, it's really unknown which of those two effects will be greater. And as Jerome Powell sort of pointed out in his speech, it's too early to say, which way things will shake out. What I'd say is we probably need around 2 or 3 months of harder data, especially on consumer spending, business investment, and the labor market. So currently, there's a lot of noise, but we probably need a bit more tangible data coming through. And then in terms of potential cuts, that's still the likely direction of travel. It's possible that, you get a decrease in the noise in markets and you get clearer data signals that, you get a first cut potentially in June. But July is probably something at Morningstar, which we think is somewhat more likely.
Sean, if we zoom out and look at global markets more broadly, outside of the US, of course, what are some of the key themes you see driving performance right now, and how have those shifted over time?
So I think there's a few. I'd probably highlight two. So I think the first is fundamentals versus, let's call it, sentiment. And you can wrap that sentiment around politics, geopolitics, and more generally, the broader global economy. So I think, there has been a shift where asset prices, 23 and 24 last year were mostly driven by sentiment. And again, especially in equity markets where the prospects of large cap US companies were being extrapolated well ahead of what we thought the business's economics really justified. And you had a market that was almost priced for perpetual US dominance or exceptionalism. I think the advent of DeepSeek and the fact that, AI was potentially being developed outside of US markets was the catalyst that we saw for investors really revisiting those expectations. And that was really the first leg of that US tech sell-off that we saw at the start of the year. That's really led to a rotation into emerging markets. And again, China's been the main beneficiary there. And then the second shift that you've seen really in markets has been post-Liberation Day, again, where we had that sort of U.S. sell-off and then a broader market sell-off and subsequent recovery in the U.S. as well. So I think, again, it's anecdotal at this stage, but if you look at the rotation, away from U.S. equities and the U.S. market in aggregate towards Europe, again, that's more supportive of a fundamental based approach that investors are taking, again, where they're just more conscious and cognizant of price, as opposed to just tying these lofty growth expectations back into sentiment. So that's a very clear sort of shift that we're seeing in the market. And then I think the second one is really, I wouldn't say it's a new theme, but really this trend that we've been seeing around the world in terms of deglobalization, and that does appear to be accelerating. I think, most investors today, we've lived in a world where globalization has created significant benefits. I suppose people can debate how equitably those gains have been distributed. But if you take it, then you just sort of oversimplify an economy like China, for example. Globalization, division of labor and trade has been massively positive for emerging markets. We also shouldn't forget, for example, South Africa and how sort of the commodity super cycle in the mid-2000s really improved South Africa's fiscal and monetary policy position. Now, so I think the gains from globalization, while not necessarily being equally spread, has been net positive. But we do appear to have come to this inflection point where the national interests of countries and regions, to a lesser extent, are being prioritized over global prosperity. And then woven into that, you have this increased geopolitical risk. So this plays out in markets where you have safe haven assets like gold running pretty hard. And you also sort of have, you know, trade secrets around next generation technologies like AI and machine learning being safeguarded and regulated almost at the government level. So I'd say those are the two main themes, and they play out in markets on a daily basis in a fairly pronounced way, which is why we think, you know, adopting a very fundamental approach and being cognizant of price is probably the best way to go about things in this type of environment.
Speaking of which, Sean, there is a lot of uncertainty out there, and a lot of that is outside of investors' control. How would you advise clients to approach the current climate?
You know, that's the most important question. So I think, you know, maybe first just a disclaimer, this is not, you know, investment advice. I think, you know, using a financial planner and taking a more holistic approach is always the best way to go about looking at your specific financial goals. But I do think it's useful to potentially look at a general framework that the average investor can consider. So I think the most important thing is really identifying investment goals and then associated with that, your ability to tolerate risk. Those two things are largely going to guide, you know, the most suitable or appropriate investment strategy in markets right now, which are particularly choppy. So it's maybe a bit of an oversimplification, but, you know, if an investor, if you're looking for inflation plus 1 or 2%, you're probably better off served in more, let's call it, income-centric strategies or portfolios. There's really no incentive to increase expected risk by allocating more to equities. So with fixed income and in bonds particularly, you've got more certain cash flows. So holding, you know, government bonds to maturity, you're likely to earn, you know, the face value and you're likely to earn the yield to maturity. So your risk is really contained by not allocating to equities or more equity-centric allocations, which carry a bit more risk. So I think with equities, those cash flows are somewhat more uncertain, and also market prices, like we're seeing, are a lot more volatile. That being said, if you need returns, for example, to achieve your goals of 3 to 4% potentially above inflation, you know, you possibly need to lean more into equities, and then, as a consequence of that, also extending your investment horizon to achieve those goals. So a rule of thumb would be, you know, on average, if you're looking for more income-centric returns, you're probably looking at 3 to 5 years, where, for example, if you need more aggressive returns, you're probably looking at 7 years plus, especially in environments like this where returns are not linear. And then I think the most important thing there is, you know, sticking to your plan and making adjustments as circumstances change. And then again, just more generally, I think, you know, what we try to really prioritize at Morningstar is a few concepts that we think, you know, hold true in different types of environments, diversification being the main one. I think this is still the best, let's call it, free lunch that you get in any type of market. And this is really, you know, spreading assets globally. And that's really helped reduce the impact of market volatility. And it also reduces the impact of any single shock or scenario. And then I'd say, being patient, we usually refer to it as being long-term. But again, that's probably one of the more important things in terms of mapping to investment horizon, especially in public markets. You know, investors are not being compensated on a short-term basis because there is still a lot of sentiment that's driving those prices. So being patient and staying invested, you know, through very difficult environments. And the last thing I'll probably say is just focusing on valuations and fundamentals would help, largely ignoring the noise in markets like these.
Sean, let's move closer to home and turn to South Africa. Market seems to be holding up relatively well, and the rand has also rallied strongly against the dollar lately. And you touched on this earlier, but how have your views evolved on local versus global assets? And what's your fair value estimate? And lastly, how do investors manage currency risk in portfolios right now?
Jeroen, so I'll start with our fair value for the rand, because this is always fairly contentious. So our fair value for the rand is around 1450. So that's obviously well below where the currency is currently trading, you know, despite some pullback over the last week or so. In saying that, you know, we are not dogmatic about absolute valuation levels. So the way that we really think about, let's call it that fair value, is more an estimate in terms of sort of gauging or judging, you know, what sort of price movements are extreme. So in terms of implementation, you know, we really look at that number in terms of a guide. But for example, you know, if you look at an extreme currency valuation, you know, we've been north of 19 fairly frequently. But if you remember sort of when Regulation 28 was changed, the currency was, you know, trading just above 1550. So the rand trades within a fairly wide band. The way we really think about this is we want to be more opportunistic, you know, when it's trading towards the bottom end of that extreme band. So what that means is, for example, we'd be more likely to take money offshore where we think the rand is sort of closer to our fair value. And again, we want to be a bit more deliberate in terms of bringing currency back when it drifts towards the higher end, I suppose, of that valuation range. So the rand is, you know, a double-edged sword. It's an extremely liquid currency, which does give you, I suppose, that price discovery. But it can also, if not managed properly, it can be a driver of returns, which ultimately you're not wanting to include in client portfolios. So if we look at, let's say, local assets versus global assets, to the first part of your question, you know, on average, we still think that South African assets are relatively better priced than global assets. We have seen, obviously, global developed market equities come back a bit, especially in the US. And we also have seen emerging market assets run. But on the whole, we still think South Africa, the equity market in particular, so if you look at those three super sectors that we have, financials and industrials, we still think are trading below fair value. Resources are very much driven at this stage by gold and platinum to a lesser extent. We think those are somewhat more fully priced. And also we somewhat circumspect in terms of, you know, how those returns are actually delivered. But I'd say on the whole, we think, you know, South African assets more attractively priced. South African bonds or our, let's call it, highest conviction idea across, you know, the whole investment universe that we have. The way we really think about constructing South African funds is ultimately through the lens of, like I mentioned to you, those investment strategies. So for a more cautious mandate, where investors are leaning more towards income-centric returns, we would favor South African government bonds. You know, you're sort of clipping a coupon of close to 10.5%. So that's a really good sort of starting point for for income-based investors. Whereas on our more aggressive portfolios, we would typically lean more into an offshore component. And that's largely because, you know, on average, we'd expect, you know, global markets to deliver sort of better returns than South African assets. So we increase risk on those portfolios by pushing the offshore slightly. But again, making sure that we maintain adequate exposure to South Africa, again, where the assets are relatively cheaper.
Sean, as a last question, is there a silver, or should I say, rather say gold bullet in this market? You know, the gold price has surged and central banks across the globe are ramping up their allocation. And as you referred to earlier, to it as a safe haven asset. But are you allocating to gold? And what role do alternative investments like gold and other things play in a client portfolio?
Yeah, everyone. So gold is actually a very sort of interesting asset. I think, you know, on a standalone basis, we still don't think it justifies its place in a portfolio, especially like I mentioned in the context of a South African investor. You know, we do have an opportunity set which is, you know, priced below what we think it should be. I think when you look at gold in particular, you know, we think the better entry point for gold is actually through the gold miners. If you look at companies, for example, like Harmony, AngloGold, you know, these companies right now are making lots of money because the gold price is excessively elevated or massively elevated. So I think the way we would think about sort of unlocking that gold thesis or the sentiment that's really coming to gold, instead of going through the metal, you know, we really look at overall resource exposure And then we'd also look at the gold exposure within that resources bucket. So right now we think, you know, that again, the resources are probably closer to fair value, maybe than they have been, you know, over the last 12 months. But at the same time, with an elevated gold price, we do think the miners, you know, come out particularly well in an environment like this. It's also a part of the market that's very much been driven by sentiment. So you mentioned, you know, central banks, you know, have been accumulating gold. And especially, you know, post the Russia-Ukraine war, we also saw this being ramped up quite substantially. So we do think South African investors, you know, benefit directly from this through the construct of the local universe, and that would be our preferred entry point. When it comes to alternatives, it's really something that we have started sort of investigating, but more from a global perspective, because there, I think, you know, when we frame it, it's not purely just around hedge funds or gold, but we specifically look at things like liquid alternatives. And this is important because, you know, we are in environments, for example, where fundamentals can take a longer time to come through. And what we're really trying to build into our portfolios is what we call this asymmetry. And that provides us with a bit of robustness to portfolios. What we're ultimately looking for is a diversified portfolio of assets or portfolios of assets that really fire at different points in time. So I think 2022 was an extreme example where you found, you know, government bonds and equity selling off at the same time. The focus very much, you know, on our side at Morningstar is to explore the alternatives opportunity set, and particularly this convergence between public and private markets, to potentially look at ways that we can support portfolios and build in some asymmetry. So that's more on the global side, where we've got a wider investable universe, where we think, you know, investors can also get, you know, overnight liquidity. The South African market is developing in this space, but it's still quite small. And because I mentioned assets relatively cheap in South Africa, not something that we're actively allocating to at this point in time.
Well, that brings us to the end of another fantastic discussion around markets and the minds behind them. With uncertainty still very much up in the air, it's crucial to stay informed, stay agile, and lean on trusted analysis to guide your investment decisions. Thank you, Sean, for your time and insights and for joining us for another episode of Mind Over Markets with Morningstar. We look forward to meeting with you next month for another in-depth discussion and some actionable insights. To all our Citywire South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Money Markets and Mastermind with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer Vera Loba de Silva from the Citywire Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Ayono.fm. All Citywire South Africa podcasts and videos are also available on our homepage. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.